Turning now to the book of Judges, chapter 17 and verse 1. The book of Judges, chapter 17, verse 1. And there was a man of Mount Ephraim whose name was Micah. And our general title is Faith Demonstrated in the Book of Judges. And we come to the last portion of the book where there will be no sign of any judge. And there will be no sign of faith demonstrated in a positive way, but we will see faith in earthly idols, faith in multiple gods, faith in all kinds of things, by complete contrast with the faith of the judges who we've looked at in the previous chapters of the book. Why is this closing portion of the book here? And where does it belong? Well, it's easy to see where it belongs, except that we tend to misunderstand the key statement about timing of these passages. For instance, in chapter 17 and verse 6, in those days there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And that verse occurs in this chapter in the context of the man Micah and his house of gods, his ephod, teraphim, the consecration of one of his sons, totally improperly, who became his priest, who was neither a priest nor a Levite, nor did the man Micah, an Ephraimite, have any rights to appoint him and consecrate him. And in connection with these departures from the faith, idolatry, abuse of the law, which they were supposed to observe, we find these words. And they could do these things freely at this particular period of time because there was no king in the land. Now, quite often, in fact very often, people take these words which are repeated and they say, well, what we're told here is that it would be much better when the monarchy occurred. But when the time, namely the period of the judges, when there was no king, terrible things happened, and idolatry in particular. And the explanation of the Bible is there was no king in those days. Well, it's quite wrong to understand the words in that way, because that would make the Bible fallible. For the Bible to provide this editorial comment, not once, but twice, three times, that the things that happen in the chapters from chapter 17 happened because there was no king in the land, implying that had there been a king, they would never have happened, and having a king would be a far better situation than having a theocracy. Having a king was to be desired. Well, that would be quite wrong, because under the kings, things were just as bad, if not much worse at times. You'd see the Bible tripping over its feet, as it were, entering an editorial comment that was quite preposterous, because the idolatry wasn't cured by the monarchy. It wasn't cured by the kings, the majority of whom, the kings of Judah and Israel, were idolaters themselves. So the passage can't possibly be an editorial comment saying, aha, this is happening because there was no king in Israel. The term king, strictly, the Hebrew merely means reigning person, applies here to anyone. There was no judge at the time these events took place, and no judge is named in these closing chapters. There was no judge, there was no prince of Israel who was prominent. Among the great number of princes, tribal princes, there was no one who stood out, who took any authority, or could do anything about, or wanted to do anything about the situation. There was no Moses. There were no Joshua. There were no people of that kind at the time. So that tells us when this period was. This period is before the judges, and that's what this explanation is about. The things I am narrating at the moment, we're told, occurred because there was no authority, no reigning person of any kind, whether a king, they hadn't come yet, the kings, a judge, a Moses, a Joshua, an elder, a prince, there was nobody functioning in any way in the land. Now, that couldn't possibly be a period at the end of the period of the judges as marked by the end of Samson in chapter 16, because Samson overlapped with Samuel, and they were functioning, part of their reigns overlapped. Reigns, I say, their periods of being a judge. There was no room for these terrible events on the end. So these events occurred, and this is a technicality in a way, but it's very important, because without this, the book really makes little sense. These events from chapter 17 to the end occurred between chapter 2, verse 15, and chapter 2, verse 16. Chapter 2, verse 16. The chapter has recorded the outrageous decline of the children of Israel after Joshua and after the last of the elders. And because of the decline and the idolatry, they couldn't prevail against their enemies. They couldn't continue the conquest and the possession of the land. And verse 15, whithersoever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had said, and as the Lord had sworn unto them. And they were greatly distressed. Verse 16, nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges. And during the period of judges, as we've seen, the times of prosperity and peace greatly exceeded by three times the periods of oppression and misery. But it was in that decline period after Joshua of the and the elders that the events at the end of the book took place. And the repeated comment, these things happened because there was no reigning person in the land, neither a judge, nor a Moses, nor a Joshua, nor an elder, nor a prince, firmly puts the events earlier in the book. And I showed you, but I won't repeat these things, that there are other clear evidences too in these chapters that they occurred earlier on. I'll mention just one which is relevant to the study before us, and that is that a family of the tribe of Dan migrated all the way up to Laish in order to conquer a tract of land for themselves. And the reason given is that the Danites were not settled. They hadn't wholly settled their territory and their land. Well, of course, it's quite inconceivable that the Danites were not in possession of their land by the end of the period of the judges. You're talking 300 years, friends. No, this is at the beginning of the period of the judges that these events take place, before the judges. And the last recorded in chapter 16 was Samson, who overlaps with Samuel the very next book. So let's look at chapter 17, verse 1. There was a man of Mount Ephraim, whose name was Micah. And he said unto his mother, the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from thee, about which thou cursest, and spakest of also in mine ears, behold, the silver is with me. I took it. And his mother, who had pronounced, it appears, blood-curdling curses on the thief, said, blessed be thou of the Lord, my son. Either she was an extremely forgiving lady, or more likely, she was very relieved to have the silver back and to understand that it was still in the family. Quite an event. Micah, a rich man. As you read the narrative through, you discover he has not a house, but houses, in the plural. And they're formed together in a kind of compound. We read also further down that there's a great wall around this compound. It is a gated compound with a multiplicity of houses. So he's well-to-do. And he has grown-up sons. And he has the money to hire a Levite to serve as a priest. What's a Levite doing, serving as a priest? You can see how slack things had become in those days. You could hire a person, you could call a personal priest, and he wasn't a priest. He was a Levite. But they blurred the edges of everything during this period of decline. They shouldn't have done. It was not long after Joshua and the elders. How quickly people can decline in their faith and in their religion. especially when they're nominal believers, as these were. And when you see very rapid decline in church history, you may be sure that the reason is that the generation that were in the front end of that decline were largely nominal believers, not true believers, for things to slide so quickly. Sorry to speak about another land, because the same thing has happened here, but you see in the United States that just a few years ago it seemed that there were huge numbers of evangelical Bible believers everywhere, so many churches, and within a couple of decades many of their evangelical seminaries and their churches have opened the door to error which denies the very basic things of the faith. And when decline happens that quickly, you realize that many of those so-called Christians were not true Christians, truly converted Christians at all, just nominal Christians. That's always the situation when suddenly there's a headlong downward rush. But to come back to this second verse, it's quite fascinating. Matthew Henry has some wonderful comments upon it. He sees this lady as somebody, she later says, verse 3, when he had restored the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver unto the Lord from my hand for my son. I intended to give it to you anyway, to make a graven image and a molten image. Now therefore I will restore it unto thee. Well, as Matthew Henry asks, why didn't she give it to him? Well, for the simple reason, he speculates a little, she loved to gaze at it every day and to count it frequently. She couldn't bear to part with it. And then somebody stole it. And it seems that she suspected him, because she raced up and down in the house like a mad woman. But this is a little bit of speculation. And made such a noise pronouncing these curses in his ears. Why would she make sure he heard the curses? Because she thought he'd done it and wanted to frighten him into returning the money. You get some nice household scenes from Matthew Henry. And so this is exactly what happened. Micah eventually couldn't bear, superstitious man, the curses, and he restored the money to his mother. But look at what is going on in this family, this wealthy family. She said that she had intended it to be wholly dedicated to make a graven image and a molten image. These are Israelites. What are they doing with graven images and molten images? The indications are that these are going to be images of the true God. That's a contradiction in terms, obviously. How would you know what the true God was supposed to look like? This was banned by the second commandment and ever so many other instructions under the law also. But you see the kind of point which religion had descended to. We'll have our religion and then we'll mould it to our liking. We'll take some parts of it and not others. We want to worship the true God and have our very own priest, and we want to worship idols too, and we want to worship our true God in the way that is forbidden. Everything was being adjusted and adapted to their thinking, to their what they liked. And don't we see that today? Even among many who say they're Bible believers and true evangelicals, they have some of the Bible and throw away other parts. They adapt freely. They say, we want the Bible, we want faith, we want Christ, we want the world too. We want to do things our way. We want to refashion worship. We don't like that reverent worship anymore. We want everything to be different. Exactly what was going on in this period of decline after Joshua and the elders. We'll have some elements and we'll reject others. And so you see here, between verses 3 and 4, the money is going to be restored, 1,100 shekels of silver. Well, what happens to that decision? Verse 4, he restored the money unto his mother, and his mother took 200 shekels of silver. Well, that's less than 20%. And we can look disapprovingly of that, but we better be careful. Have we done the same thing? Have we dedicated ourselves to the Lord and our lives and our time and a certain portion of our resources for him? and given only 20%, maybe, or immediately taken some of it back. So before we judge this semi-pagan Israelite idolatrous woman too harshly, we better make sure that our own dedication is honest and right and fair. She gave less than 20% of what she claimed to have promised to the Lord. And she gave the money to the founder, who made thereof a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. But that's not all, because in verse 5 we read that Micah already had a load of things in a shrine in that house. They'd been idolaters for some time. These, by the way, are the first recorded idolaters since Joshua and the elders. There may have been many others, but these are the first to be recorded in the Word of God. Verse 5, and the man Micah had an house of gods, and made an ephod, and teraphim, that's a plural term, little figures, Canaanite god figures, that you use in seeking the will of God, and an ephod, a very rich garment, for anybody who would serve as his priest, and it was a garment of guidance too, and consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. Well, as I said, that's utterly disorderly and outrageous and wrong. He's a pretty freewheeling character, Micah, and he does whatever he thinks, whatever he plans, and here his own son, or one of them, is a priest. And there's the comment which condemns his actions. In those days there was no king, no reigning authority in Israel, and you did what you liked. And that's so widespread today, isn't it? And we have to make sure we don't catch the disease. And as sincere Bible believers, do many things just because that's what we want to do. And I've made these comments before. I think of our giving ourselves to the Lord and seeking of his guidance and praying that we'll be serving him and yielding our futures to him. And then do we go on from there to promptly make up our own minds on major policy matters in life without prayer, without deep thought, without thinking through the scriptural implications and our spiritual duties? So we don't want to be the same as they were. Now verse 7. There was a young man out of Bethlehem, Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there. And the man departed out of the city to sojourn where he could find a place. And immediately we ask, why? What is this wandering young Levite? Why is he straying from, well, he had 21 Levitical cities, a choice to live in his land. And, of course, Jerusalem. He wasn't supposed to be outside any of those, unless he was on a specially appointed mission. But he was looking for somewhere to live. He wasn't interested. He was a Levite, and he claimed to serve as a Levite. In fact, he was happy to serve above his station as a priest, which implies that he made sacrifices. An outrageous disorder like that. It isn't actually stated, but it's implied by the term priest. But what's he doing wandering about? Was he in trouble? Some people speculate so. He couldn't live, they say, in one of the Levitical cities because he'd done something wrong. That's possible, but it doesn't mention that in the text. But anyway, he came to the house of Micah. And verse 9, Micah said unto him, whence comest thou? And he said unto him, I am a Levite from Bethlehem, Judah, and I go to sojourn where I may find a place. And Micah didn't ask him any questions. I hope nobody does this when a pastor is to be called, or somebody is to be appointed for some spiritual task. Micah doesn't make any inquiries. He's delighted to have a Levite. Dwell with me, and be unto me a father and a priest. He had no right to say that. And I will give thee 10 shekels of silver by the year, which actually was less than he would have been getting if he'd lived in a Levitical city where he should have been. That's what makes some people suspect he was a man on the run from something. But again, that's only speculation. And he will also give him a suit of apparel. The Hebrew says a double suit, two suits. And thy victuals. So the Levite went in. And the Levite was content to dwell with the man. And the young man was unto him, unto Micah, as one of his sons. The son that was appointed evidently didn't mind budging over to this Levite, who was a priest, and it was obviously a good place for him to be, and a beautiful place, and he had a comfortable dwelling of his own. And verse 12, Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest, and was in the house of Micah, managed religion. Managed religion. You appoint your own, your very own pastor who'll tell you just what you want to hear, who knows his place, your own chaplain. He's on your payroll. He doesn't mind your idols. He won't reprove you for swerving from the path. And this young Levite seems to have been delighted, very pleased to carry out functions and read the services in Micah's idolatrous shrine. No doubt he represented the other deities also. Who knows? But he was happy and utterly compromised. And verse 13, then said Micah, now know I that the Lord will do me good, seeing I have a Levite to my priest. What an extraordinary statement. Now that I've got not only a shrine, not only have I outrageously made a molten image of the true God or represented him, and a carved image of him, and smashed the law in pieces, not only have I am I worshipping other gods and I'm putting other pagan gods, idols, right alongside the so-called representation of the true God, but I've added to that mix a Levite as a priest. A whole list of wrongs and one little right. I've got a Levite, which he shouldn't have had. He should have been back in one of the 21 Levitical cities. And he says, now the Lord will do me good. And he doesn't mean the kind of thing you might mean by that. Oh, if the Lord would do me good. I think if you use that kind of phraseology, you would probably mean, I hope, that I'll have assurance and blessing and instrumentality and greater holiness. But make no mistake, Micah didn't mean anything like that. By do me good, he meant I should be even richer. I should be even more secure and powerful. And people will hold me in even higher esteem because I have a Levite on my payroll in the household. That's the sort of thing that he meant. And that's the picture that we've got here. He wasn't supposed to have a shrine. Moses had been so emphatic about this. It's all laid out in Deuteronomy 12 when he tells the people, now there are certain things we've done on our wilderness journey which are only temporarily done. And when you come into the land that God has promised you, these things will be done no more. In the future, in that land, God insists there'll only be one place, one shrine for the offering of sacrifice. And God will appoint it and show us where it will be. And there must under no circumstances be any sacrifices offered but at the one place. At this time it would have been at Shiloh. Ultimately, of course, it will be in Jerusalem. But there'll be one designated appointed place. And here's a man, got a shrine, which implies sacrifices, and so does a priest, in his own home. This is an outrage all the way through. The adaptation of religion, the adaptation of the faith. Friends, it is going on all the time, even around us, in churches. So much adaptation and bending of God's rules. So we have to be very clear on this. The faith of Micah and his mother, well, look at this. They have 1,100 shekels. They've got a lot more, which was supposedly dedicated to the Lord. Just a fifth of it is taken and turned into images. They turned the money into gods. But the money was of God either way. I think Matthew Henry's quite right. I dare say every day that lady looked at it, gazed upon it, revelled in it, counted it. It was a god before she turned any of it into a god. She had an invisible god. I don't know whether the rest of the family knew. She closed the door of some room and counted her money and worshipped her god. And then it became public when it was made a moulded image, graven image too, and put into the shrine. Secret gods, public gods. So first of all, there's an idol in the mind, something dreamed about, something wanted badly, something over-planned and revelled in, and then ultimately it's turned into reality, and the too expensive thing is bought and paraded and all the rest of it. And you can see idolatry here, and we can see it in our own lives, and we have to fight it and make sure it does, because if you get into covetousness and idolatry, it gets a real grip of you, as it did these people here. It goes from one extreme to another. Now chapter 18. In those days, the remark comes again, there was no king in Israel, which is supposed to point you back to an earlier portion of the book of Judges, before the judges. And in those days the tribe of the Danites sought them an inheritance to dwell in, for unto that day all their inheritance had not fallen unto them among the tribes of Israel. Now that's a very kindly way of putting it. Why not? Why had not all their inheritance fallen unto them? Well, we go back to Judges chapter 1 and we can see the reason. It's spelled out more clearly. Judges chapter 1 and verse 34. And the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountain, for they would not suffer them to come down to the valley. So the Danites are one of the neither dids, the long list of neither dids. Neither did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites, neither did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron, neither did Asher drive out, and so on. And apparently neither did Dan drive out the Amorites, but were stuck in the mountains because they didn't have the courage and the faith to honour the Lord and drive out the evil Amorites, and they took so much of the land of Dan. So you come back to Judges chapter 18, and the Danites were squeezed for space because they hadn't yet got all their inheritance. And as we read from chapter 1, that was their fault, their lack of faith. And verse 2, the children of Dan sent of their family 5 men from their coasts, men of valour from Zorah. They didn't seem to have many men of valour from Zorah and from Eshtaol to spy out the land, some land they probably didn't know what. They were going to go touring and to see where they could get some good, lush, unprotected land, in the event they had to go far, far north. And the instruction is, go search the land. And they travelled. It's very condensed here, the narrative. End of verse 2. Who, when they came to Mount Ephraim, to the house of Micah, it almost implies they knew him before, but not necessarily, they lodged there. When they were by the house of Micah, they knew the voice of the young man, the Levite. Either they knew him, which is unlikely, or it means that they realized his accent was one of somebody from Bethlehem, Judah, and not those parts. And he was probably, may have been, repeating something liturgical. And so they listened. And they turned in thither and said unto him, who brought thee hither? And what makest thou in this place? They knew he was a Levite. It was obvious when they approached him. And, as I said, probably from what he was doing, some religious recitation. And immediately, this is the low state of the time, immediately the assumption was, oh, here's a Levite on the make or something. What's he doing here? What advantage brings him here? And the question they ask would be quite insulting. If you had respect for someone, who brought thee hither? And what makest thou? What do you make here? What hast thou in this place here? And he said unto them, Micah. And he explained, he's hired me. I am his priest. He doesn't mind as a Levite calling himself a priest. And they said unto him, ask counsel, we pray thee. This is so interesting. What are they doing asking counsel of a Levite who's out of his place, who's got a shrine and is officiating with pagan gods as well as a forbidden model or representation of the true God? And anyway, on this journey from Eshtaol, they've passed right by Shiloh. Didn't they call in there, where there was the high priest and the appointed place to make sacrifice and to seek guidance? No, they haven't done that. They're not a bit interested in the guidance of God until they almost fall into a shrine, stumble into it, and then all of a sudden they're religious. Ask counsel and guidance of us. Well, I hope our faith is not like that, forgetting our prayers to God, forgetting our devotions, unless we bump into the necessity. Ask counsel, we pray thee, of God. And of course, the young man, he knew how to act as a professional, and I'm quite sure artificially he says, go in peace before the Lord is your way wherein ye go. He knows how to function as a professional priest. And verse 7 of chapter 18, the five men departed and came to Laish and saw the people that were therein, how they dwelt careless after the manner of the Zidonians, quiet and secure, no magistrate in the land that might put them to shame in anything. And far from the Zidonians, evidently Zidon was their nearest neighbour, and had no business with any man. They couldn't believe it. A beautiful place, lush and provided with everything imaginable. And these people, who had no defence, no militia, absolutely secure, and they returned with great speed, no doubt, to Zorah and Eshtaol. And the narrative is fascinating. Do look at it, friends. Chapter 18, verse 8. And their brethren said unto them, what say ye? Which seems to reflect a kind of impatience. They'd waited for them to come. They'd been away, perhaps some little while. And they're just anxious to know, is there any news? Is there anywhere we can go? This is not all the tribe of Dan, of course. As the narrator waits to the very end of chapter 18 to virtually tell us it's only a small bit of it, one clan, one family. But anyway, what say ye? And in verse 9, everything seems to be back to front here. I think today, if we were going to make a report, we'd rather long-windedly say, well, we went up to Ephraim, and we were directed there to such and such a place, and we went to such... Yes, yes, come on, what did you find? Well, we found a fantastic place. And there are orchards and beautiful fields and agriculture can thrive there and so on. And yes, but surely it's defended. Ah, well, this is the point. Then you'd come to the crunch. These people are so detached and so far away from anywhere, and they have provided no defence. But these five spies are so excited that they put to our way of thinking, the end of the report at the front, and the exhortation which we would save to the end right on the beginning. And they said, arise, that we may go up against them, for we have seen the land, and behold, it is very good. And are ye still? Be not slothful to go, and to enter to possess the land. They're very excited men. When ye go, then they get to the explanation, ye shall come unto a people secure and to a large land, for God hath given it into your hands. That's not really a very religious statement on their lips. It's their way of saying it's just there for the taking. a place where there is no want of anything that is in the earth. Don't you think you'd start with that in your report? But anyway, there is great excitement. And there went out from thence of the family of the Danites, out of Zorah and out of Eshtaol, 600 men appointed with weapons of war, another indication of what a small portion of Dan this family or clan is, to have only 600 fighting men. And they went, and it would appear, with many wives and many children, because little ones are mentioned later on. And they went up, and they pitched in Kirjath-Jearim in Judah, and they called that place Meoneden, which means Camp of Dan. And it kept that name ever afterwards. But then they arrived at the house of Micah. They took that route. The spies led them, verse 13. Then answered the five men, verse 14, that went to spy out the country of Laish, and said unto their brethren, Do ye know that there is in these houses the collection of Micah's properties, an ephod, and plural teraphim, and a graven image and a molten image? Now therefore consider what ye have to do. There's something left out there which we're left to guess. The plan is told them, and I think it must have been along these lines. The priest will come out. He'll meet you in the gate. You engage him in conversation. And we five, the spies, will go into the house and we'll just take these idols and we'll bring them out. And you engage the priest in conversation. That seems to be the picture. Verse 16. The 600 men appointed with their weapons of war, which were of the children of Dan, stood by the entering of the gate. And the five men that went to spy out the land went up and came in thither and took the graven image and so on. And the priest stood in the entering of the gate with the 600 men that were appointed with weapons of war. They preoccupied him. And the five, the narrative is kind of repeated, went into Micah's house and fetched all the bits and pieces. And when they brought them out, the priest said unto them, What do ye? That's the question. And they said unto him, Hold your peace, lay thine hand upon thy mouth, and go with us, and be to us a father and a priest. For is it better for thee to be a priest unto the house of one man, or that thou be a priest unto a tribe and a family in Israel? And the priest, the Levite, was delighted, and he himself took hold of the forbidden images and went in the midst of the group. And so they all turned and departed and put the little ones, which some people think is a reference to the teraphim, but that would be very strange, I think, more likely a reference to the children and the wives that were travelling with these 600, and the cattle and the carriage before them. They would have gone very slowly with cattle and families, so it wasn't surprising that when Micah got home, he'd been somewhere, he collects together a posse from his own staff and possibly others also, and caught them up in verse 22. And verse 23, they cried unto the children of Dan, and they turned their faces. What a marvellous narrative. They just turned. You can see what's going to happen here. They are now so superior. The five spies were once very glad to have the hospitality of Micah, but now they just turn their hardened faces and say, What's the trouble with you that you come with such a company as this? They're a superior force. Oh, I'm afraid I get a picture in my mind of how gracious and pleasant and nice the theological liberals were when they were a minority in our historic evangelical Bible-believing denominations in this country in the 19th century and then the 20th century, and how gracious they were and how kind. And then when they became just strong enough and they'd taken the colleges, and they were perhaps a majority in the denominations, then their attitude is quite different. Get out, you evangelicals. We don't want you. You hang around here, and we'll get rid of you. You can see it almost reflected here. This is what happens. You play games with idolatry, and forces of darkness come in, so friendly, so nice, until they've got the upper hand, and then they're hard as nails. And poor Micah, well, I don't really feel that sorry for him, because what happened is that, verse 23, they cried unto the children of Dan, and they turned their faces. And verse 24, he says, ye have taken away my gods which I made, and the priest, and ye are gone away. And what have I more? His heart was in those things. And what is this that ye say unto me, what aileth thee? And they reply with a death threat. Any more of his crying out and trouble from him, and they would just kill him and his household. And so the children of Dan, verse 26, went their way. And when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, of course they were, he turned and went back unto his house. Now I'm going to make some application. We've very little time left. Verse 27, they took the things which Micah had made, and the priest, and came unto Laish, unto a people that were at quiet and secure, and they smote them with the edge of the sword, and burnt the city with fire. We often make evangelistic use of these passages. People who live securely in life, far, far from the help of God, have got to face the end of life's journey and the destruction of the body. You can see all this pictured here in the city in the fall of Laish. Verse 28, and there was no deliverer, because it was far from Zidon, and they had no business with any man. And it was in the valley that lieth by Beth Rehob, and they built a city and dwelt therein. But look at the tragedy of verses 29 and 30. They were very proud of their ethnicity, these Danites. And they called the name of the city Dan, after their father. However, it was founded on idolatry, verse 30. And the children of Dan set up the graven image. And now the young Levite is named Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh. He and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land, which some people think was all the way until 722 B.C., when Tiglath-Pileser and the Assyrians took the whole region into captivity. But if you don't mind my saying so, I think the people who argue that the captivity of the land refers to the Philistines overrunning that part of the country just in the early stages of the life of Samuel, and then it didn't last long. They were priests, I think, for something like 250 years, and then Dan, Laish fell, and so did their priestly dynasty. Didn't last that long. Verse 31, and they set them up Micah's graven image, which he made, all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh, which would match that. It was when the Philistines took the ark from Shiloh that Dan fell, and Jonathan and his sons, his successors, were no more. But what a passage this is. My time is out. Compromise, compromise, all the time. Even among Bible believers, moving away constantly. And you see it here. It's a reflection of this downward period. Why, I go back and I think of names of people who are sometimes, well, praised and extolled among Bible believers. John Stott, who used to be the rector of All Souls, Langham Place. Many years ago, compromising with Rome, holding discussions with Roman Catholic representatives and dignitaries. In the 60s and the 70s, working hard to persuade evangelical Anglicans that they ought to be aiming at ecumenical alliances with Rome, saying that the beliefs of the Church of Rome on fundamental things were no different from the beliefs of Protestants. What compromises when there's a downward movement? The name of Dr. James Packer is revered today by many. But I can remember when back in the 60s, James Packer was one of four authors of a book, Growing into Union. Two evangelicals, two high churchmen within the Church of England, and they said there was nothing between them. They were totally agreed, and this book expounds the Roman Catholic doctrine of salvation. Exactly the same as the Protestant doctrine. That was all those years ago. Somebody said to me once, Dr. James Packer, hasn't he fallen from where he used to be? And I said, no, he's always been in an utterly compromised doctrinal state and condition. But this sort of thing is right back here in the book of Judges, where you adapt and you compromise. And now today, as I'm always trying to say, you've got it with worship. You believe the Bible, and you have all the entertainment styles of the world in the church at the same time. I notice that among the charismatics, the Pentecostalists, there seems to be virtually no difference between oneness Pentecostalists who deny the Trinity and Trinitarian Pentecostalists, and they all join hands together now and praise each other and so on. Absolute muddle and confusion, and you've got graven images representing the true God, which you shouldn't have anyway, at the same shrine with idols, with things that have no connection at all with Bible Christianity. Well, you see it all in here. This is what these accounts are recorded for. What happens when true religion just collapses into confusion and into idolatry? Dr. Ted Williams' book, Christ or Therapy, that's so important. And for so many churches here in this country who have been drawn into the new psychological way, instead of preaching Christ and the remedies of the Bible for Christians who are not actually sick but are suffering from sadness and grief and depression, instead of using the Bible for the means of sanctification, we pay counselors and we use absolutely secular methods, and so many churches are doing this. Somebody was talking to me the other day and saying, do you know about Dr. Tim Keller in New York and the magnificent mega church built there, and so rapidly under a comparatively short time? What a wonderful work. Yes, but how does he do it? How has Dr. Tim Keller built his church? Well, I'll tell you, he's built it mainly by having every conceivable kind of musical genre. Whoever joins the church can join a band, an orchestra, a jet, whatever he likes. The world is laid on and so on, and all the psychologizing is there and all the counseling. Every method which the Bible would condemn. You've got a shrine and you've got every conceivable god in that shrine. And people applaud it, because lots of people are there. This is magnificent, even though it's just compromise. How downhill the movement goes. We've got to stick to the scripture. I'm sorry if this is a depressing subject. This is faith in everything but the Lord and his word and obedience to him and what he says. And that is what this passage is all about. So, dear friends, I must conclude. This is faith in true religion plus idols, because really we don't have faith in true religion. That's what this passage is about. It's belief in sacrifices, so it seems, but in our own way, on our own terms, we will adapt the faith of Moses. We want a Levite, but we don't want the law of God and the Ten Commandments and all the instructions and the worship given under Moses. We want to think we're Jews, these people, but on the other hand, we don't want to go where the Lord has sent us. And we don't want to claim his promises and conquer the land that he's given us. That's too hard for us. We want to find somewhere easy. Find a place on the earth where people are living securely, and we just kill them all and occupy that and have a good time. And do it some other way than the way which the Lord appointed. So don't just preach the gospel and pray and knock on the doors and round up the children and have to have prayer meetings. Don't do the hard thing. Bring in the bands and do this and do that. Do it a different way. You'll get far more people. It doesn't matter whether they're really converted or not. It's numbers and income and appearances that we're interested in. You see the comparisons with all this. These passages are for us, friends. And in the end, they're rebellious and hypocritical and self-determining and quite immoral. So if you've ever wondered why chapters 17 and 18 are in the book of Judges, it's for this kind of warning and application. So faith, dear friends, let's keep our faith unmixed with faith in worldly measures and things. Let's keep our faith obedient to the Lord in everything. Let's apply our faith to our practical conduct, what we do, as well as what we believe. Micah fell. He lost everything. Jonathan and his sons, the Levite, fell eventually. Laish, newly called Dan, that fell. And evangelicalism is going to fall, or at least great swathes of it. In your lifetime, if the Lord doesn't call, I don't know about mine, but in your lifetime, you'll see these great swathes of evangelicalism that are compromising will be evangelical no more. You'll see them give that up altogether, and they'll fall, and they'll be absorbed to what? Maybe Rome? Maybe oneness Pentecostalism? Something quite outrageous and miles away? But it's all going to fall. Just as the denominations in this country, as they compromised, they all fell to liberalism. It'll fall. That's the lesson, the solemn lesson of Judges. So we stick to the Word of God, and there is blessing and power and preservation. Let's close with the singing of hymn 544. A very